Building a company from nothing is freaking hard. Us entrepreneurs are expected to deal with unimaginable challenges and somehow keep a cool head through it all. This is The Art of Entrepreneurship, and I'm your host, Jackie Hermes. I grew my company, Excelity, from 0 to 7 figures with no partners and no funding. The Art of Entrepreneurship is a show where we cut through the BS and dig into what it actually takes to start and grow a company. If you give me your time, I promise it won't be wasted. Now let's get to work.
Hello and welcome back to The Art of Entrepreneurship. Today I am talking to Stephen Puri, and this is one of those interviews that really surprised me. I feel like most of them are, I mean, all of them are amazing, but this one really, I guess, made me look at life and work in a different way. So Stephen spent years as a Hollywood exec before becoming a founder, and he is now one of the most thoughtful voices on remote work and performance. What caught my attention isn't his background, although it is very impressive. It's how well he understands the pressure that high performers put on themselves, especially when work becomes flexible. Sometimes that freedom actually makes you feel like you're working harder than you did before. And if you are feeling that right now, this is going to resonate with you.
Okay. Stephen, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
You know what? Thank you for having me. I hope this is one of the most engaging and maybe actionable episodes that you've ever done.
I already know it's going to be based on our chatting before this. So, okay. I've read obviously all about your background before we met. And while I was reading, I was like, how exactly does a Hollywood executive end up where you are? And you're such a strong voice on like remote work and a bunch of different topics. Mm-hmm. Like, tell me what the through line is there.
Ooh, okay.
Like, a little bit of background.
This is a good one. And for those playing along at home or listening in the car, the reason to listen to this episode is I'm one of the few or maybe only people you'll meet who's been a senior executive at two motion picture studios and also raised over $20 million of venture and run 3 startups, 1 successful exit, 2 failures, you know, and it's true. You learn more from the failures, you know? So here's the funny thing that not a lot of people realize, because most people, they want to talk about Die Hard and Wolverine and Independence Day and whatever. And maybe they know something of what I did, you know, in tech. Yeah. So here's the thing is, I am the son of 2 engineers. My parents met because they both worked at IBM. My mom was a software engineer. My dad was a chip designer, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, your parents are great tennis players. You probably played tennis when you were a kid. It's just like one of those things. So when I went to USC, not necessarily for computer science, software engineering, I had a Watson scholarship from IBM that guaranteed me a job as a junior software engineer. So I made money during school as a little code monkey while I'm at the University of Southern California. And a lot of my friends are in this cinema TV school. Lucky break number one, I am in LA getting out of college when film goes digital, which means suddenly the film industry needed people who could speak engineer and also speak creative. And I could bridge that. And that was that intersection of the Venn diagram. There were very few people in that area.
Yeah.
My career took off. So I did 14 movies doing the digital effects, from True Lies to Braveheart to Independence Day. We won the Academy Award for the visual effects on Independence Day. It was a great time. My first company I set up with the director, producer, writer of Independence Day, Roland and Dean. The three of us set up a company, raised $15 million, which, let me be honest, it's not super hard when your last film won an Academy Award for visual effects.
Makes sense.
You know, 4 years later, we were acquired by Das Verk. It was a great exit for me. I'm like 28 years old thinking, you know, as one thinks in their 20s, you're actually smarter than you are, better looking than you are, you know, like funnier
That's
than you
so
are. Later, you realize it's not all true. But at the time, you're like, oh, I've already sold a company. I'm 28. It's great. So that for me was like a, oh, wow, what do I want to do next? Like, so far, the 20s are going really well. And I thought, I've worked on a number of movies, making the digital part for someone else's vision. How could I be the guy like getting a movie greenlit, getting a whole movie made? And that made me start climbing the ladder, being a studio executive. As you know, I ended up vice president of production development at Fox. So I was running the Die Hard, Wolverine franchises. I was an executive vice president at DreamWorks for Kurtzman Orsi, and that was the era of like Transformers 1 and 2, Star Trek 11, Eagle Eye, Fringe, you know, a bunch of stuff like that. And how I got back into tech is probably Die Hard 5 is the straw that broke the camel's back, where I'm telling you, part of how they lured me, the chairman of Fox lured me from DreamWorks to say, you probably grew up watching the Die Hard movies. I was like, I did. He's like, would you like to be the executive on the next one? I was like, wow.
Yeah.
I guess. How do I say no to that, right? And so I said yes. As it turns out, and this is probably a really big lesson, I should have listened to more of my friends who told me that there was a big sort of values mismatch, misalignment between myself and News Corp, which I'm going to leave at that. But let's just say style comes from the top and Rupert's style infuses every business deal that's made there. And after a while there, I'm on Die Hard 5. It's a terrible script. It was getting made just as a money grab because they're like, hey man, you could put out almost anything with the words Die Hard on the poster. It's going to make like 70 million. So as long as you make it cheaply, you make money on it. And I was like, wow, that's an inspiring way to live your life. If you make it cheaply, you should be okay, you know? And two, you know, Stephen and Stacy's credit, who ran DreamWorks when I was there, they really did try to make great movies. Like, it's hard to make a great movie. There are many bad ones, but it's not really because people set out to make a bad movie. It's just hard. And at DreamWorks, there was a culture of like, make something great and hopefully it makes a bunch of money, as opposed to, can you make it cheaper? Right. And that's when I was like, I got to get out. You know, I hated my boss. He hated me. I was just like, you know, there is the job above me, you know, moving up to be chairman. I was like, I'll never get that job. He hates me. Like, I should go find something where I'm doing something meaningful. And I thought, what's the other thing I know how to do? Engineering. So I got back. And this is when the entrepreneurial thing moved from trying to get movies made to trying to get actual companies built. And that's how we ended up creating, you know, the Suka company and Flow States and all that kind of stuff. So it's almost like, rather than a linear progression, it's kind of like a clock where it came back to 12.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that totally, I love that analogy. Okay. I definitely watch all of that and I need to see how it holds up today, you know, because
good question. Who knows? And the film industry is very different than it was then. You know, you can feel the contraction. Like when I was leaving, a lot of our staff meetings were our bosses, the chairman of the studio complaining about, oh, kids used to go to the movies, but now they're on this social media stuff and they're on their Xboxes and they have options. They don't have to go to the movies every weekend. And we're like, yeah, the world evolved. Like, you're 60 years old. Like, do you have kids? Do you have grandkids? Like, can they tell you what's going on?
Right. So, got to adjust.
Films change.
Yeah, absolutely. So through all of this time, did I read you've been working remotely for 20 plus years or how?
You know, here's a funny thing people don't realize. Yes, pandemic shocked the system. Oh, we can't be under the same fluorescent lights 10 hours a day. We'll kill each other. Da, 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 right?
Yeah.
Zoom became a verb. In the film industry, remote and hybrid work have been around for 100 years. If you think about this for a moment, you'd be like, oh my God, you're right. Every film begins with writers writing at home or in their writing partner's living room or going to coffee shops and writing remotely. Hopefully one of those ideas gets some traction. A producer or a studio that's involved, there's a little bit of money. You open a production office. 2 days a week, you go in there to meet with the costume designer. Well, what should they be wearing? The location scout. Could we shoot this in Milwaukee? You know, like, so you do that. And then the rest of the week, the writers go off for 3 days and they're doing a rewrite to try and get Brad Pitt to say yes. And the location scout's off in, you know, Montana, whatever. So you go through the hybrid and then you're on set and it is like RTO for months at a time, like all day, all night. You're shooting the thing, principal photography, you know. Then you go back to hybrid, you know, editors going in and out of editing suites and Foley and, you know, sound effects. And then eventually it's remote again. So that whole arc of remote to hybrid to in person to hybrid to remote, leaders in film for 100 years have known how to lead through each stage and individual contributors have known how to contribute. It's just kind of how it works. So it wasn't like a huge shock to the system. The biggest shock in film was just, oh shit, to be on set or be on a soundstage is dangerous right now. Not like, oh, how does remote work? What is this remote thing? So it's been really helpful in terms of translating that to how do we work today?
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, and something we were talking about a little bit before we got started
is this idea of remote work being freedom. And it is in some ways, right? Like I've been working remotely now for years. And mm-hmm. I was one of those people that was in an office. We actually had just gutted an office and moved everyone in before COVID. So that was fun.
You had a lot of great timing.
Yeah, I know. You know, it's okay. It makes a really good story. And then we never went back because everyone was like, I don't want to do this, right? Like I have found what it's like to have the flexibility and be at home. And, you know, like with me and my teens, when they have a day off, they're just here and I'm here. It doesn't need to be like a big, okay, who's taking care of the kids and whatever. Yeah. But I think it also just makes you available at all times if you don't have good boundaries. What do you think about this idea of like remote work being freedom?
It is a wonderful way to open this conversation because you're right. There is freedom. There's flexibility in that. There is also massive opportunity for distraction, right? Mm-hmm. Massive opportunity for boundaries to be blurred or non-existent, right? And suddenly you become responsible for saying, how am I making myself successful? And I know a lot of your audience, including you and I, we are entrepreneurs, right? So yes, there was an era like my dad's era where you went to IBM, you sat at the desk, you did the things assigned you by your manager, you turned in your chip designs and they were fabricated and turned into chips, right? Yep. And then there is you and I, and probably a lot of people listening, where you wake up in the morning, you go, where do I apply myself today? How do I do it? How do I divide my day between dealing with existing clients and existing projects, finding new work, growing my business? Yeah, you know, like suddenly mm-hmm. the freedom can be chaotic.
Yeah.
And this is a lot of what I speak about now because, you know, what I do now is I run a flow state community, a community of people who are almost all remote workers, almost all entrepreneurial. They're, you know, engineers, developers, they are designers, they're writers, bloggers, or authors, right? And all of them work from home or work from coffee shops or work from, you know, Bali, wherever. And they're thinking, how do I be successful in this world of freedom, as you put it? So that I think is a fascinating road to go down. Back to you in the studio.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's how do I be successful? And then how do I deal with the pressure? And I think it's pressure that we put on ourselves, especially mm-hmm. if you're a high performer or you have high expectations or both, right? Yep. It's like there's always that list and there's always something to do. And mm-hmm. you know, you can choose to sit and do it tomorrow or you can choose to do it right now. And I unfortunately am still making a lot of the latter choices. Sometimes I'm better with boundaries than others, but my old business coach used to say, like, this is a you problem. You need to set and hold boundaries. You know, it's not, mm-hmm. it's not anyone else. And I do think that there are some offices, corporations that as they have sent people home, they've said, oh, you're available at 6 now, right? Or you're available at these different times. How do we deal with something like this? And how do you advise people on, you know, like setting those boundaries and communicating them to other people?
Okay. Given the contained nature of this podcast and the question you're asking, which is like, how big is the ocean? It's big, right?
Right.
So I'm going to try to be as concise as I can be to cover a number of things. But if there are any of those you want to go into, let's do it. Okay. So let's talk about what are the things you can do that take advantage sort of in a neuroscientific way of structuring things from home? Like what are the boundaries and how do you have an on-off switch, right?
Yep.
Now, there is, of course, a place in your home that you work. But when you work at home, you can work anywhere. You can, like I used to work in the kitchen in the morning because I have a laptop. I'm in the kitchen in the morning making breakfast. Oh, the light is beautiful. I work here for a while. Go up to my office midday, end of the day. I'll be down on the sofa. And then, you know, my wife works in banking. So like we're both end up on the sofa by 5 o'clock wrapping, you know, that sort of thing, right? Now, I'll tell you a funny thing is I learned when I was, this is Independence Day. This was the first time I saw really high performers, like guys who are writing some of the top, you know, grossing movies in history.
Yeah.
And how they associated mental space with physical space and they used it as a trigger. So Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin, who had written, you know, Universal Soldier, Stargate, a bunch of stuff, right? So they had this vacation rental, or they would go to this vacation rental in Puerto Vallarta, apparently some beautiful white marble mansion in the hills of Puerto Vallarta, where they'd go write. So when Roland told his assistant, Joey, hey, you know, go go rent the place for 2 months. We need to go right. She came back that afternoon and was like, it's rented. It was like an Airbnb before Airbnb. It was like, someone else rented it already. It was around the office. It was like someone died. And I was like, wow, this is really extreme for like, you can't go to the vacation rental. And Roland called his entertainment attorney, John Diemer, who's a fantastic attorney. I was like, John, buy the villa. By Monday, Roland owned a $5 million villa in Puerto Vallarta. Do not know where the current renters went. I'm sure they were nicely paid to pack their bags and find another villa in Puerto Vallarta, right?
Yeah.
And I was talking to Dean about this. I was like, man, you know, I'm just a little kid from Virginia. Hadn't really quite seen someone drop $5 million on a Thursday. So what? And Dean said this to me. He said, you know, there is a room there where in the morning the light comes in over the pool. And in that room, we never think about cast availabilities. We never think about studio notes. We never think about budgets. We just write the movie we'd want to see. So it's kind of worth it for us to have that available. Now, they went down there. They came back 6 weeks later with the script that became the third highest grossing movie in film history. They knew something of how their brains worked. And it's not to say that you need a $5 million villa, because I'll tell you, years later, when I was leaving DreamWorks, I was EVP at DreamWorks for Kurtzman Orsi. Alex and Bob wrote huge billion-dollar franchises, Transformers franchise, Mission Impossible, Island, you know, Zorro, all sorts of things. And what's curious is when they got in crunch time, they would have their assistant rent a room across the street. DreamWorks was on little Amblin compound, which is at Universal Hollywood, right? Across Lancashire, there was a Universal Hilton. It's not a luxury property. It's where you go with your kids the night before you go on the rides. You know what I mean? That's the only reason you're there. They would have their assistant rent a room there for a couple of weeks. And they would go there like it was the office to write. And I was like, these guys are pulling down $1.5, $2 million a script. They could go to Bali. They could go anywhere to write. Why this? And it hit me. They met back when they were students. I think for them, this evoked like dorm room. This was Kurtzman on the edge of the bed with his MacBook and Bob at the desk with his MacBook and writing away. We have to prove ourselves. We're these scrappy young writers. And they would, yeah, finish Transformers 2 in 2 weeks, going to the Universal Hilton and staying in a hotel room all day.
All right, y'all. It's shameless plug time. I want to take a quick break to chat with you about Excelity, my full service marketing agency. For the last 12 years, we've been working closely with B2B software and service companies. Now we are expanding and looking for growth stage companies with a bold vision, but maybe lacking the marketing strategy or resources to get there. Or hey, you might have resources that just aren't working out. We definitely see that all the time. At Excelity, our team gets results and we have a ton of fun doing it. I'm sure you can tell that from listening to this podcast. So if you or someone you know is a fit, check us out at excelitymarketing.com or reach out to me directly on LinkedIn.
So I relate these two kind of funny anecdotes to say, you really, if you start to work from home, want to respect that you can train your brain to say, oh, I'm in this room. This is where I do X. And the more you do that, when you enter that space, your brain will start to naturally fall in. The same way like a flow state works. Your brain gets trained like a muscle to say, oh, now we're going to do the deep work. The work that actually differentiates us from an LLM, that from, you know, an overseas offshore contractor. You know?
Yeah. The deep work. I just saw something online the other day that was like amount of deep work done by employees or by anyone, who knows, from the 1990s to today. And it was just like shifting through all the years. And the deep work chart went from like 3.5 hours down to like, I don't know how small it got, but like the emails got bigger, the meetings got bigger. Now we're sitting doing a lot of that stuff instead of focusing on the deep work. So that environment is huge.
And guess what?
Yeah.
Everyone who is worried about, people usually say AI when they mean large language models because they conflate the two. So I'm going to say LLMs, right? So when you're talking about people who are like, oh my God, all these jobs are gone and people aren't hiring and the LLMs are doing the copywriting, they're doing the graphic design, they're doing the coding, right? Absolutely. LLMs are not thinking machines. LLMs are probability engines, right? So they're very good. Like Google autocomplete when you're typing says the next character is probably S. I'll just suggest S, right? LLMs are simply Google autocomplete on steroids. They're like, oh, the next character is probably this. The next word is probably this. The next idea is probably this. And it feels to you when it gives you back a probability of like, hey, man, I read the whole internet. You probably are going to want this next as thinking, but it's not, right?
Right.
But here's the deal. Every company, as you know, in their quarterly reports right now and on their shareholder calls is talking about, hey, we just are saving all this money by doing, you know, reductions in force, by using LLMs, AI to get rid of people. We got rid of 2,000 developers. We got rid of 400 copywriters, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? Now, here's the deal. I know you and I are talking to an audience right now, people who are trying to create something great and meaningful. And what you said about the amount of time, if you look over the past couple of decades, that people spend on deep work during the day has decreased. You want to know what? That deep work is the only thing now that LLMs can't compete on. Mm-hmm. All the other filler garbage, the repetitive sort of like rote tasks, LLMs are really great at it. They'll do it all day long for a fraction of a billionth of a penny. So if you are an entrepreneur and you're like, how do I outpace everyone? Yes, totally take advantage of LLMs. But you better find your time in the day when you are doing the deep work that no one else can do, because that is where you're going to win. And that's the entire community, you know, that I created is around how do you get into a flow state to do the work where people go, wow, how did you think of that? As opposed to, hey man, I had an LLM write my blog today. And what do you think? Reads like every other bit of AI slop out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
AI slop is such a big topic right now. And I think a lot of people really struggle to get in flow, or they feel like it is the work that is important, but not urgent. And I think that that is a big part of the
matrix.
Problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And when there are so many things that seem urgent, like an email response, whatever else it may be, a Slack, and you have all of this stuff kind of distracting you, it is really getting into that deep work feels like you have to shut everyone out.
Seriously. For people who haven't read deep work that we're referencing, like Cal Newport's stuff, he's fantastic about differentiating shallow and deep work. I have a question for you. I'm sure part of your audience is familiar with flow states, or like, I'm a flow master, I can get in flow. And another part maybe has a casual acquaintanceship with, should we define flow state just?
Yes.
Okay. So everyone's equal footing. Okay. Here's the deal. I'll try and keep this concise. A Hungarian-American psychologist, this guy, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, took a while to learn how to pronounce that.
You did great.
Thank you. Somewhere. He died, what, 3 years ago? 3 years ago, like last month or something. I hope he's smiling as I pronounced his name properly. So he had a thesis. He goes, if you talk to high performers in various disciplines, athletes, artists, scientists, inventors, blah, blah, when they talk about the highly concentrated state they go into, you know, when they do the stuff that makes them famous, that changes the world. It's really weird the way in these varying disciplines, they talk in very similar terms about this state. And he's like, what's up with that? So he did a bunch of research, a bunch of interviews, and at the end of it, he wrote a book called Flow. Mm-hmm. It is the seminal work on this. It is from whence we get the term flow state. And he said the greatest thing. He said, I chose the word flow because it was the most beautiful metaphor for what I found. We are all on the river paddling to move ourselves forward. But if you align your boat with the current, it carries you. It magnifies your efforts. You go further and faster. And that is what these high performers have figured out how to do, and to do it repeatedly. And it is a fantastic thing. I'm passionate about it now. I will tell you this. The first time I experienced flow state, I didn't know what a flow state was. I was flying from Austin, where I am now, to SF. And the next day I was meeting with my team and I wanted to like mock up a feature in Figma. I don't have great Figma skills, but I can kind of, you know, blunder around. Yeah. I want to mock this thing up to go, hey, what if we built something like this? And if you like it, let me hand this off to you and we can finish it, right? Got on the plane. Alaska runs that nonstop. Captain's like, sorry, kids, Wi-Fi's out. You know, see it SFO, right?
Oh, I hate when that happens.
I know. So we took off like 15, 20 minutes later, we start descending. And I was like, oh, something's wrong with the plane. We're landing in DFW. They're going to swap the plane. They're going to tell us, oh, the hydraulic system went out. We don't want to scare you. Like something bad happened. They don't want to tell us yet. I looked down. 2 hours and 40 minutes had gone by. I had no idea. I couldn't tell you if the drink cart came by. I couldn't tell you the name of the fat guy in the seat next to me. Like, what? But my designs were done and I liked them. And I had prepared myself for, you know, get in the Uber, grab a sandwich in the hotel lobby, go up to the room, try and finish for the morning meetings for thing. In reality, I was done. Like, I got in the car and I called a buddy of mine in SF. I was like, hey, you want to have dinner? I have a free night. And that feeling of being ahead of the day as opposed to like behind the day.
So good.
Was remarkable because I was like, what was that? Now, in hindsight, I realized, you know, both what Mihai wrote and then really like standing on the shoulders of giants sort of thing, really smart people have dug into his research and done their own research on specifically how does music help? How does, you know, awareness, how do you block distractions? How do you do all these things? So I realized that was a flow state. And I know now that having a flow practice is the thing that differentiates people from, you know, the people that kind of like work really hard, but at the end of the day, they're like, I was so busy, but what did I get done? You know, it's like you didn't set aside an hour or two to go deep because that's how you win. No billion-dollar company won because everyone returned their Slack messages. You know?
Yeah. Oh, that's so true. And I've read a lot of books on, you know, just like how to make this time, how to do those things, but not as much on how to get into flow. And you did just, yeah, I would love to, because you just said you need a flow practice and how do you develop something like that?
Okay,
I know so with maybe 5 minutes left we have, so
we're gonna speak the English real quick.
Love it.
So there are some characteristics that Mihai laid out. He said, you know what? These flow states, and a lot of people I spoke to have their own names for it. He's like, Michael Jordan has that, you know, when I'm in the zone, it's me and the ball. And Picasso talks about it this way. And Einstein talked about that way. But he's like, we're going to call it flow for here. He's like, you lose track of time. You're not watching the clock. Mm-hmm. You do your best work in a compressed amount of time. Distractions fall away. And at the end of it, you can feel a sense of joy or uplift as opposed to a sense of depletion and like, oh God, I need a nap, right? And there's more to it than that. But he sort of said, it's really interesting the way your brain, when it falls into the state, you just sort of like burrow through stuff and you look up, you go, wow, that was amazing. I feel great. And I did this. So people, because now, you know, obviously Kotler and Newport and Near and everyone spoke about distractions and all this, right? But they've dug in and said, what are the conditions precedent that help you get into the state? One, you have to time block, right? Research shows it takes 15 to 23 minutes to get into a flow state. You don't just snap your fingers like, I'm in flow. Right. It takes room to get into that, almost like an athlete warming up, right? And if you're in it and you get interrupted, oh, I have to go make lunch. Oh, this Slack message came through, the Teams message. It takes you another 15 to 23 to get back, right? So you really have to, in your calendar, say, I'm setting aside this sacred time. You can put it as, you know, a meeting with me, deep work time, focus time, flow time, whatever. But put in your calendar, don't let other people book meetings over it. Don't, you know, answer Slacks, don't answer emails, right? And you're going to need an hour or two. So time blocking is step one. And you have to say, I'm serious about this and treat the time as sacred. Music, ton of research on the neuroscience around music and what it does to help you fall in. And it's interesting, there's a bunch of research on like fMRI scans of jazz musicians as they get into improv and how their prefrontal cortex kind of like shuts down. You get into that rhythm, that zone where it's flowing, right? Yeah. So here's the thing. For most people, the sweet spot is 60 to 90 beats per minute. Music that's certain key signatures, non-vocal. You're not singing along with Blackpink or Britney or whoever, you know, whatever era you are, right? And we all have friends who are an outlier. Oh my God, I have to listen to the Wicked soundtrack, or, you know, a 90s gangster rap gets me there. So there's always the friend who's like out there. But for most people, it's that. Like when we were creating Suka, Suka is a flow state website to help you get into flow, right? So we took all the pieces you need and said, I want to be in one site with a play button. I happen to have a bunch of friends who are film composers who have time on their hands. Hey, could you write me a whole bunch of original music to these sort of scientific specs, right? Awesome. Like 1,000 hours of original music. We sort it into playlists. You can have like more upbeat or down tempo or lo-fi beats or binaural, whatever, right? If you dig it. Tell you one of the big things I learned about this association, same thing like the mental space and the physical space. Buddy mine up in Marin, Julian, does a lot of the sound for LucasArts for the Star Wars games. Mm-hmm. Called me up. It's like, hey man, I just got back from Nepal. It's my kid's graduation present from high school. You did a great job and this is what he wanted. One day we're in Kathmandu, it poured rain so hard we couldn't leave the hotel, the bed and breakfast, whatever, right? It was this lush, delicious, like warm rain. I had my recording equipment, so we're stuck there, and I recorded 2 hours. Do you want it? I don't really know what to do with it, so I just thought maybe you'd want it for your, you know, your app. So I was like, okay, cool. We threw it up there quietly, just called this playlist Himalayan Dream Rain. It's 2 hours of a loop of rain in Kathmandu. It became the third most popular playlist in our entire platform.
Wow.
And I was like, what up with that? I did not see that coming, because we have all this expensive, beautiful music made by film composers, and then we had rain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I run the platform so I can see who's listening to it. And I email a couple people, hey, man, will you chat? I'd just love to understand better why you're choosing rain over all this music. And I tell you, if you were to boil all the response I got down to this, it was people saying, you know what? It brought me back to a period of time when I had to work or study and it was raining. Oh, I grew up in my grandmother's house in Georgia, and it would always rain around finals in the spring. My memories of having to stay inside and study, the rain triggers that. And people talk about their lake houses, where they grew. And it was so interesting to go, oh, so you really, once you become self-aware, you go, this helps me get there. And there is a popular blogger whose name you may know. She reached out to me when she saw we did this rain thing. She's like, hey, if you're open to non-music playlists, can I tell you something? I had a kid during the pandemic. I used to write my blog in a coffee shop near my apartment house on our shifts. I can't really go there anymore. Like a two-year-old, I can't really hang in the coffee shop. She's like, any chance you could put up a playlist that just reminds me of a coffee shop? Because that evokes in me, like I'm in my blogger mode. And Tony, my partner, found a guy in Vienna, Austria, who had recorded a couple hours of his local coffee shop, like the espresso machines going, you know, and plates clattering. I put it up there. It got to be incredibly popular. I listened to, we called it Cafe Vienne for Vienna, Austria. Mm-hmm. I listen to it sometimes. It's kind of cool. It reminds me of my film days when I'd go to this coffee bean and tea leaf because there were so many writers there. It was kind of fun to hang out and read scripts there. And so I shared that. I know we're out of time, but there's a lot more we could talk about. But here's just some things like oral triggers, AU, oral triggers, physical space triggers that help you get into flow. And then, you know, another time maybe we can talk more deeply about like how to apply for flow practice and things like
that. Yeah, absolutely. If people want to find you and read more about everything you're talking about, where should they go?
Really easy. I'll give you two things. Number one, my email address is very public. So if there's anything I've said where you're like, I would love to read a blog post about that, or can you send me a link to this Hungarian dude or whatever? Steven, Steven, at thesukha, which is the name of my company, thesukha.co for company. So the Sukha company. Sukha means happiness. I will not write you back the history of my life because you don't want to read it. I don't have time to write you, but I will give you, oh, here's a great blog from Cal Newport that'll help you with that or whatever, right? Yeah. And if anyone wants to try getting into flow, that's literally the site we built is the Sukha, thesukha.co. It's free for 3 days. Try as much as you want. Use it for 72 hours straight and do something great with your life. You know, that would be the greatest gift to me is someone being like, hey man, I finished my novel thanks to, you know, having flow states.
Yeah, that's very cool. You know, I have identified some updates that I could make to my own routine as we've been having this conversation. Yeah, and you know, I think people are going to get a lot out of it. So I really appreciate you being here today, and for everyone listening, share this with one person that needs it. And frankly, everyone needs to hear this conversation because I think we all struggle to, you know, set boundaries, get into flow, all of
those. We all do. No matter how smart we sound, we all need help with that. Yes. Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. Thank you for having me. And thanks to everyone who's still listening.
Thank you.